Hello, welcome to another episode of Everything is Canon, a Cinelings podcast, a podcast where we discuss the latest books and novels with the people who wrote them. I'm your host, Steve Duncan. However you may have found your way here, thanks so much for tuning in. If you like that intro music, you've got great taste. That's Sam Witwer and the Crash Tones. If you want to hear more of the Crash Tones, you can download their latest album, Revenge of the Crash Tones, on iTunes or visit samwitwer.com. Today we're talking with author Rebecca Coffendaffer all about her great debut novel, Crown Chasers. This first book in a duology follows roguish pilot Alyssa Farshot and her sidekick Hellmonkey as they are thrust into a galactic Easter egg hunt, the Crown Chase, with the winner becoming the next ruler of the universe. It's a fun sci-fi romp with a ton of heart, excellent plotting, and a cast of characters you won't soon forget. Rebecca and I talk about the excitement of her debut release, having a book come out in 2020, and all the inspiration that went behind so many of the great choices she made in Crown Chasers. Remember, this is a spoiler discussion, so please, if you haven't read the book and don't wish to be spoiled, better stop listening now, but definitely double back after you've read the book. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. We have a great one today. There's been a ton of great debut novels this year, and another one just dropped yesterday, and I'm talking about Crown Chasers. And today, we have the author of Crown Chasers, Rebecca Coffendaffer, with us today. Hello, Rebecca. How are you?
Hi, I'm so good. I'm so excited to be here.
Like I said, this has been the year of a lot of great debut novels, and one of the things, and not just for the debut authors, but for any author this year, not a great year to release a book. and that's for a bunch of reasons. Number one, there's just things happening in the world out our front door that are more important. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't enjoy the things we enjoy or love the things we love. In fact, we should hold on to those even more. But what I'm really specifically talking to, of course, is the pandemic. And that's really done a number on people this year. And one of the great things I love about authors, especially when they come up with a debut novel, is you get to go out into the world and talk to people, and throngs of people line up and tell you how great you are and how much they love the book and how it's affected their life in this way or that way. And that's great. And you deserve that. And you're being robbed of that this year. And I have no doubt that you probably wouldn't have been in New York next week like the rest of us for Comic-Con, and it's my favorite con. How has that been for you this year with the debut novel, and how are you just dealing with the pandemic in general?
So we're going to come out, you're coming out with the big, big questions right off the bat.
Yeah. We're going to, and then it'll just get, it's downhill from here. Don't worry.
It's definitely like, nobody would necessarily choose to debut in the middle of a pandemic and a crushing economic recession and everything being sort of on fire. And you're over here going like, yeah. But do you want to buy my book though? So it is very strange to try and balance what is such an amazing accomplishment, and so many of us debut authors have been working so long to get here, and you know, we do deserve to take that time and sort of revel in it.
For the first part, I have two small children, so like my travel was going to be probably sort of limited and local anyway. So I would have loved to go. Oh man, I would have loved to go to New York Comic Con. I don't know if that was ever on the program. Because everything sort of, when it blew up last spring, it was like, well, events are kind of off the table.
I had decided early on I wasn't going to attend, even before they officially canceled it. Whatever form it was going to take. I was with you sort of back in the spring. The thought of just being around that many people scares the shit out of me. So normally.
That's just, it's a lot. I'm one of those extroverted introverts, so I can, I can manage that without completely going bananas while I'm there. But afterwards, it's just like, don't talk to me for days. Please don't.
Yeah. My thing is I get like crazy anxiety when I go, and it takes me a few days before I get comfortable. And by the time I am fully comfortable, it's over.
I'm just settling in.
Honestly, that's how it is. So it's kind of weird, but, I'm with you. I sort of made the decision early on. I was like, okay, that's just, you just,
that's going to be a wrap on the year as far as that stuff goes. But yeah, and that's what I mean. It's real bummer for me as someone who enjoys talking to and spending time with authors. And, you know, it's, that's the time for you, you know, to set aside, you know, any humbleness and accept the glory, you know, because releasing a book at any time is such a big deal, and a debut one too. And I know how much effort and emotional, you know, how much emotion you guys pour into these things. And yeah, it's just, it's a tough year for sure. And I'm hoping for maybe a redo next year. So hopefully you'll get to go out on the circuit next year and, you know, have
people. Yeah, that would be nice. The nice thing about the online community is that because the biggest thing is that as a debut, you don't have other books to sort of, you know, you don't have as much of an established platform to build off of. And a lot of established authors in the YA community and the middle grade community have been doing what they can to boost debuts mm-hmm. online as much as possible, making room for debut voices because they have been there and they've recognized, you know, how difficult it must be to try to scramble for a voice in this space and try to get heard and try to, you know, just get a little attention and buzz built up around your book. So I have to give major props to the Kidlit community because they've really have been doing what they can to try and make space for the debuts to step out of the shadows a little bit.
I totally agree that the online, everyone's been coming together and that it's just, you have to, that's kind of the way it is right now. Right. That's how everyone's going to survive. If anything is to succeed, this is the way it's going to go with everyone coming together, like you said, online, digitally. Make sure everyone out there signs up for these digital panels and digital bookshops and workshops whenever they're available. And those have been fantastic. I've been enjoying a lot of those. And that's kind of the silver lining, I guess, if there is one, right? That you've been able to do these online events and that's given it a much broader reach than, say, a local event has, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think... I have several virtual events coming up in the next couple of weeks and that's way more than I thought I would be able to manage. And a lot of the stuff I can manage because I can do it online. I can do it virtually. It's less of a burden, to try and figure out, you know, what I'm going to do, you know, with the kids and all that kind of juggling that comes with, physical travel. And then also it's opened up, and people have been pushing for it to open up spaces for people, for marginalized voices who maybe don't usually get to do the travel. Maybe they're international authors and they can't get over here, or maybe they just, you know, we don't Midwest and we don't make a lot of money necessarily. So right. That, you know, trying to get travel costs and everything covered, virtual spaces have meant that we've gotten to hear from a more diverse selection of authors in some places than we would have otherwise, which I think is fantastic.
And one of the things I've enjoyed too is the you know, not all moderators are created equal. And one of the great things I've been enjoying for all these virtual ones is typically a lot of these people that are setting these events up are getting another author to moderate or to host. And I think that's been really great because the conversations, it's one thing to have like a dummy like me asking you questions, but to have a peer asking you questions and then you guys break out into these great conversations about process and emotion and character and plotting. It's just, that's for me as a fan, it's just been absolutely like lights out great. So I've really enjoyed that. And I kind of hope that's something that maybe does carry over once we get back into the physical realm of Earth. And,
yeah.
And maybe we'll see more of things like that because the conversations that I've, you know, been witness to just sitting in my pajamas at my computer have been, little fourth wall break there.
It's the best way to attend a panel.
Yeah, though. I know, right? So anyways, it's been a tricky year. Here's hoping we have a bit of a redo next year and you're able to go out and just receive the, you know, this nice praise that I'm sure is to follow after this book comes out. Before we get into the actual book itself, like the one thing I wanted to, I was reading an interview you did recently and I'm a big fan of process. And one of the, and this is, I'm just going to just read it, your answer. This is quoting you just so I don't screw it up. I signed with my agent a little over 4 years ago with a totally separate book, also a YA sci-fi, and we took it out on submission, but it didn't find a home. And I love that story and that would that world and those characters. But what we kept hearing back from editors, what they weren't connecting with the voice. I wasn't bringing everything I knew and felt about the main character onto the page and really bringing her to life. Really great admission, really great honest answer. And that must have been a tough time. And that happens a lot, that we don't hear about that side of the publishing world and when you're trying to break into the business as an author, as a storyteller, dealing with, you know, rejection can be harsh. Talk about that time in your life, because, you know, you've wanted to be a writer since you were very young and you finally feel like maybe you have, here's your chance. And then your first idea, your first concept, they take a pass on.
Yeah. I mean, I'll admit that that was definitely a rough time. Because of course you have a lot of hope. The submission process is, it's so full of just this weird constant tension, and you can be on submission for months at a time. And, you know, you kind of wait and wait to hear what editors think. And then your agent kind of nudges them and you get a whole slew of rejections at once is kind of what was my experience was. In the process, in the moment, it's all just like kind of hits you in the gut, right? You just sit there and you go, man, I really thought I nailed it this time. I already saw like the cover. I saw it on shelves. Like I could see it. This was the one. And it took time after that to go back to that and see what I could learn from the rejections. There's, of course, always something you can learn from rejection, from constructive critique. But it's never like when you're first presented with it, it's just like, well, nobody knows anything and this book is amazing. And they just don't understand. They just don't see it.
Right.
And you got to go back and give it time to settle. And I am an emotionally upfront person in my day-to-day life, but it wasn't coming out necessarily in my writing. And I can blame the fact that I was writing sort of an emotionally closed off character, but it still was lacking a connection. You can write those kinds of characters, but they still have to connect to the audience. So, you know, there was a skill I was missing, you know, a skill set there. I needed to find a new project to grow, because if you don't keep growing, you're going to stop being able to produce, you know, good books in the next, like I love Crown Chasers. I loved the book that we went on sub with, but I hope those aren't my best work. I want to keep growing. Crown Chasers has a lot of strengths that other book didn't have. Mm-hmm. And so I hope that as painful as the submission process was, that, you know, that gave me a leg up to write the next one. And whatever I learned from Crown Chasers, I hope I put into the next series and on and on.
Mm-hmm. You know, to your point, one of the things you said too, you know, that this is sort of later on in the same answer, you talked about holding the reader at arm's length. And, you know, that's such an important part of it, especially when you're not doing IPs, right? You know, readers really want to get a sense of who the author is now. That's kind of a weird shift lately because I think a lot of that is because of Twitter and these things. We have more access to people than we ever have before. And we feel like, whether it's true or not, we know people more than we did before. Right. So, and so now it's like people feel entitled to like know you and understand you in a, without being your actual friend. So it's like there's that expectation now when I pick up a book, it's like, oh, this is from Rebecca. Well, I feel like I got to learn something about Rebecca through these characters, through these stories. And I don't know if that's an entirely fair process, to be honest with you. Are you?
Yeah, I don't know. I actually don't know that it is either. Yeah. I don't think it's possible to, like, I think you put a little of yourself in every book, of course, but I don't think I know of any author who sits down and writes a book and is like, boy, I'm going to teach some people about me. Unless maybe you're writing a memoir, but that's totally, like, I don't sit down and write a sci-fi book and be like, let's teach folks about me today.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. There is that sort of expectation these days that a book that you put out is going to have like these big chunks of you, and readers kind of expect to have that, like, to be able to pull from it. Like, this is what I know about you now.
And there's and that's a great thing too, don't get me wrong. And there's tons of space for, you know, like the our voice community, right? Which is fantastic and amazing. But, you know, I don't think we should expect that from every writer from every story for the rest of time. You know, like
No,
anyways, so yeah, I don't know. I just when I read your answer to there, I was like, Jesus, you know, I hope they didn't force you into a situation just to have a book, you know, published where you maybe felt uncomfortable revealing yourself more than you probably would have before. And that's,
I totally see what you're saying.
You know what I mean? And because, because there's a lot of pressure. It's one thing we learned about this year about the unfairness of publishing and especially with people of color and all these other things and marginalized people in general. And, you know, to get a book published has always been such a huge, momentous task. And now it just, now we know the truth of how that mountain is even 10 times higher than we thought it was. And, you know, it would really just hurt me to know that somebody was, you know, forcing themselves into an uncomfortable position just to get a book published. And your answer didn't scream that to me, but it's just like, you're like, okay, was sort of like what the feedback was. And I just hope that didn't put you in a position where you felt just uncomfortable.
No, yeah, I totally see what you're saying. Yeah. And I think that it's a valid concern because we have seen evidence of authors having to put their own lives on display to justify stuff that they've put into books, like with Becky Albertalli recently. That wasn't my experience. And I think the way I phrased that was probably a little bit misleading. It's not that I had to put more of myself on the page. It's that I wasn't letting the readers into my characters as close as they could be. So sure. It was less about letting them into me and more about like the characters themselves were at arm's length from the reader, which keeps them from connecting and caring. Yeah. So that was more my experience.
And that's probably the, you know, the biggest benefit of first person too, right?
Right.
Getting into the character's headspace and if that was a revelation or not to you, then that seemed to be a really great step in the right direction. Because, you know, if anything, we do really learn a lot about Alyssa, that's for sure. in a good way, though. Okay. So enough downer talk. Okay. Although I, again, and this is a weird process question, but I ask it of pretty much everyone I talk to because every answer is different. So it always kind of trips me up a little bit. What's your physical writing space like? Like a little corner tucked away in the closet? do you have a writing, an office? Do you have like a bunkie? Some people are just like wherever I have time with my laptop. It's every answer is different.
So it was a little bit more fluid, and it still kind of is. Like I have a little light laptop, and so it kind of goes wherever I go. And we do have an office, but when the pandemic hit, my husband has been working from home, and so he has been working down there, and he sort of took over the office. So we did invest in getting me like a little desk and a chair, and it's in the living room. So it's not necessarily like this quiet space where I can duck away, but it is an established space where I can kind of sit and be like, okay, here's where work gets done. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I do contract work and I'm a primary caretaker for my kiddos. So it is a very fluid space that kind of just happens wherever it can.
Yep. No, that's you do what you got to do, right? I mean, not everyone can afford a separate house just for writing. So like,
oh God, that would be so nice though.
Right. And you know, I've talked to some who literally like they'll rent a cabin somewhere and just to get out of the city even. And everyone's got different answers. And I'm always just so interested in how people manufacture genius, I guess is sort of how I'm going to put it. Okay. Well, we didn't bring you on here to talk only process and dire, depressing things. We're here to talk about Crown Chasers. Crown Chasers is a deadly race across 1,001 planets that will determine more than just the fate of the Empire. This explosive first book in a duology jam packed with tension and thrills is perfect for fans of The Hunger Games, Aurora Rising, and Three Dark Crowns. Alyssa Farshot has spent her whole life trying to outrun her family legacy, even leaving behind kingship and her uncle, the Emperor, for a life of exploring. But when her dying uncle announces a crown chase, a search for the royal seal hidden in the Empire that will determine the next ruler, Alyssa is thrust into her greatest, most dangerous adventure yet. That's a lot of promotional language for sure.
Yes.
You tell me what Crown Chasers is about.
For me,
and don't compare it to other, and don't compare it to other things. I hate when they do that.
Oh no, for me, Alyssa Farshad. This book is ride or die on Alyssa Farshad's character in my opinion.
Yeah.
It's about one girl who really just thinks that all she needs and wants is this this carefree life zooming between the stars, and you know, she's got her own spaceship. She just wants to have adventures and she wants to discover. She's got that Rose Tyler, like, let's see what's out there thing going on. Mm-hmm. And she is brought back down to earth, so to speak, by the knowledge that she actually has a responsibility as the niece of the emperor who calls this crown chase. You know, she has a position in this galactic empire that she has to, over the course of the book, recognize gives her a responsibility to be more than just this carefree adventurer. She has to step into a bigger role, not just for herself, but for other people whose lives are affected.
It does affect a lot of people. We'll talk about that. And it doesn't, it's funny because as hard as she tries, you know, in fact, other people's lives, that's the only thing she does, which is great, because that's drama and drama is a story. So if it was just, you know, we can't just have her flying around doing nothing either. Before we get into the story, there's one thing I do want to talk to you about quickly. Please explain to me the significance of AW421979 and 0437192251626309295525705087050.
So the 42-1979, I pulled that as, obviously, 42 is the answer to the life, the universe,
yes,
and everything.
Thank you.
And 1979 was when Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was published. So I put those numbers together for that reason.
All right.
The big long number, I want to give a clever answer, but I'm pretty sure that I just put those together more randomly because I needed a big string of numbers.
Okay.
I did look up celestial coordinates and kind of how they work. So those are approximations of what, like, I mean, I don't know that they actually point anywhere, but those are within the realm of what you would see as celestial coordinates.
And this is no bullshit. I honestly guessed Hitchhikers with that first
did
number.
You that's awesome.
42, I shouldn't even be saying this, it's not the only part of all my passwords, it's not just 42, but 42 is in every single one of my passwords that exists on Earth, whether it's my banking information, anything to do with passwords online or computers. I as soon as I saw 42, that's the first thing that always jumps in my head when I see 42. So
right.
Thank you for that.
I am absolutely writing down that little tidbit about your password.
Yes, it's not just 42. There's other characters that surround it. But 42 is a part of every one of my passwords, and it has been since I was a kid. Yeah. So I'm with you there, Hitchhiker, so thank you for that.
You're welcome.
So Crown Chasers, I know what I feel is unique about the story. You know, the aesthetics of it is standard sci-fi fare, I guess I would say.
Yeah.
It's because there is something unique to the story that jumped at me anyways, it grabbed a hold of me. But what was the aha moment for you? Because I know you said you usually start with a story, but in this case you started with a character. But again, you can't just have her sitting in a swivel chair, spinning around, whistling, you know,
right.
For 400 pages, you got to have this character do something. So what, when you started, you know, plotting out what Alyssa was, what kind of trouble she was getting into, what was the sort of, when did the crown chase come into the picture? Like, what was the big aha breakthrough for you as far as the narrative goes?
I mean, I think it was a pretty early on thing, because I wanted to combine some of those, like you said, there's some standard scaffolding that's very familiar to sci-fi and space opera fans. And I am one of those fans. So it's like, you know, just combining pieces that I loved, like the Galactic Empire obviously is not a completely new idea. And once you start there, I loved like Indiana Jones type stuff and Lara Croft where you're solving a puzzle. So when it was at this idea, like I kind of had the idea of a competition for the throne. And then once you went there, I was like, well, okay, well, how do you do this? Okay. So like there was this tidbit about, I saw it in the news or something, and it's so long ago, I don't even remember what it was, but it was about people who actually like race for something, and whoever gets there first is like an actual like leader of this certain community. I was like, well, that's kind of cool, but then how do you do that over 1,001 planets? You can't just say, you know, I even think I say it in the book, like you can't just drop a prize somewhere on 1,001 planets and say, good luck, hope you guys find it in the next century. So then I wanted to put, you know, the other elements that I loved, like, you know, like the Lara Croft, like the Indiana Jones, you find this puzzle, you're going to find something, you know, find a treasure at the end of it. And why not? Why not a treasure hunt through space where the prize is the throne of 1,000 worlds. So what I tend to do when I'm figuring stuff out is I just write in a notebook and I just brainstorm. I have to do it by hand. I have to do it in a notebook with a pen and paper, and through the process, I'll write stuff down and I'll ask myself questions, and then I'll circle back. And then I'm like, well, no, that idea doesn't work. So it's just a long process of filling notebook pages of ideas that work and kind of evolve into the story, and what other ones that get discarded along the way that I'll probably use somewhere else for another idea.
A lot of that is like, you know, sort of, you know, like the MacGuffin obviously aspect, and then, you know, the window dressing. For me though, like what was unique about this story, the part that like really grabbed a hold, first of all, the prologue was excellent. Great prologue. The part though that hooked me was the emotional beats. I cried a couple times. But certainly the one, you know, the chapter early, I think it's the second or third chapter when Alyssa goes to see her uncle, Attar.
Yeah.
And, you know, even her relationship, obviously, with her uncle is important, but even with Charlie, too. That part, just like, I was like, all right, so here, this is what this book's going to do to me. I was like, just getting started. You know, sort of her... Alyssa sort of pounding on the glass at the end when Edgar and Coy are doing their thing. Sort of like, I know you're a big Star Wars fan, sort of brought up like Obi-Wan watching Qui-Gon get mauled from Maul there at the end, you know, that feeling, whether it's a shield or a glass wall, that helplessness, right? And, you know, pounding on it. And that really got to me too. And also, as much as I don't do it myself in real life, like I'm not sentiment at all, but I really love sentiment in story. And even the parts when Alyssa was like having to say goodbye to the vagabond Quick and Rose, I was a mess. I was like, Jesus Christ. So that to me is the part, that's why I want to talk to you a little bit about the emotional element of this story, because it's one thing, you know, pew pews and spaceships and hyperspace and all these things that of course we love about fantasy and science fiction. But, you know, the reason we love Star Wars and Star Trek are the relationships. So just talk about sort of like, at what point did the uncle niece relationship sort of really come into focus? And even just the way that she does interact with everybody. She's your typical rogue, right? That sort of crusty outer shell, but chewy soft center.
Oh man. That's why I love rogues. I play them in Dungeons and Dragons. Nice. And oh, yeah, I love them.
Yep.
The basic tool that I always use when I'm building up a story, and usually the place where I start all the notebook scribbling is when you have the main character, you ask, what do they want versus what do they need? Mm-hmm. And it's not original. No, I have stolen that from 1,000 writers before me, but I think it gives you a good way to make sure that you're keeping the emotion through the book. So what does Alyssa think she wants? She thinks she wants, you know, this absolutely carefree life where she kind of tries to hold everybody at a distance. She's too cool for school, that kind of thing. What does she need? And she needs to realize how important her family is, how important, you know, her loved ones are. She needs to realize how important her place is in the galaxy and what she can do to change the universe around her. So that's kind of where I was coming from with her, you know, with her uncles, you know, this, I just, that tension of a kid who's flying the nest and thinks that they're so, you know, grown up and don't need the parental figures anymore. And then discovering, like, I guess all of my choices were like, how mean can I be? Like, she discovers too late how much her uncles mean to her.
Right.
And then when I came to the part where I was getting the climax together and I was like, well, I got to blow up her ship. Like, that's just a mean decision. But, right. But yeah, it was what's going to drive this home and what's going to propel her forward to her next, you know, her next bit of character development. What does she need to learn from this in order to grow into the person that I want her to be at the end of the duology?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was, and you know, you all, like, you just stopped just short though. I mean, you almost sort of took care of Hell Monkey, but
nope, he lived, I guess.
Yeah. And I guess you didn't, you can't, I mean, you can't take everything from this poor girl.
No, but, I'm not that mean. That's, right. That gets overkill.
Sure. But that was a great, super effective moment though, too. And because, you know, she spends so much time, like, you know, a lot of her world is the 6 inches in front of her face. And then the odd time when she does sort of break her bubble and let somebody in, and it's almost like she shakes her head and be like, well, that person got too close. Let's push them away again. So it's great the way there's a lot of push and pull with her, you know what I mean? And it's,
yeah.
it would take a lot of effort and work to really get into her space. And Hell Monkey's done that, I think. And then when you get to that one scene and I'm like, oh, you're not going to kill Hell Monkey. There's still a whole other book to go, man. Jeez. So talking about Alyssa a little bit now more, I know you said the classic Han Solo, of course, is the classic, I guess, rogue now that most people our age and this generation know about. And you've said she's sort of Cara Thrace and Jake Peralta a little bit mixed all into one big mush. But dawns on me, there's the perfect comparison in Star Wars already with Dr. Aphra. I don't know if you've read any Dr. Aphra stuff.
I haven't. That's a huge hole. I have other Star Wars fans who talk about Dr. Aphra, and I haven't caught up to that yet. So I preemptively love the comparison without having a lot of faces.
I like that comparison a lot better than Han. Number one, she's a girl, so just there's that. But
yes,
I'm a huge Star Wars guy. I used to write for TheForce.net. Big Star Wars guy. I was never a Han fan. I always thought he was too dumb. I still think that, actually. But listen, he's all heart, great pilot, great instincts, all those other things that you need to survive in that, you know, place, that the violence of space and all that. But just too dumb. If there's a lot of Dr. Aphra material now, it'd be a long time to catch up. But I think, you know, the audio drama that just came out early this year,
I heard about that. Yeah,
that Sarah Kuhn wrote. Just listen to that, because okay. it kind of does. It's sort of based on her first appearances in like a Darth Vader comic run that came out by Kieran Gillen a few years ago. So just listen to that, and that'll get you started. And I think you'll definitely, you know, you've said people have made that comparison before. I think right away you'll be like, yes, perfect. Because she's very rogue. She's got a lot of the same ideas. She's a classic rogue, but she's just really, really fucking smart. And Alyssa is very smart. And that's one of the things I liked about her the most, actually. She's very quick on her feet. She's very tactical. She doesn't take anything for granted. How important was it to have, you know, she's such a great main character. I think she's like, I tweeted the other day, she's sort of like for the ages, like a main character, because she's encompasses all these great things that you want in a lead character, right? I mean, she keeps the story going. She's smart. She's empathetic. Just like, how important was that to make, like, to have this person who's going to carry this story for two whole books? She's got to be, you know, she has to be the person that everyone likes the most. She has to be the character that everybody likes the most.
Right. Which is tough.
And in a book full of other great, and we'll talk about some of the, like, Edgar. But he's a great character, right? I love Edgar, not love the things he does, of course, but.
But yeah, interesting. You
know, yeah.
Intriguing character.
So anyways, Alyssa, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, when I was forming this book, you know, her voice and her chapters and her perspectives are the central conceit. And I kind of, when this book is, I mean, it's out now, but in the lead up, I basically sat there and thought, well, like, a reader's going to probably know pretty early on if they like this book, because if you don't like Alyssa, you're probably not going to love the book because her voice is so strong. Mm-hmm. But I wanted her to be, funny, but vulnerable, because I think when you lean too hard on humor, without layering in vulnerability, becomes a gimmick. And then it becomes just overwhelming. Like I wanted her to use it, but that you can see that she uses it like as a wall. This is why I started comparing her to Jake Peralta. Mm-hmm. But like, she uses that humor, and she goes into life with this wry sort of humor. But it was so important to build in those layers of vulnerability, so that you could see that she's not just a joke machine. Like need more than that. And I wanted to make her smart in ways that were different than just like, Hellmonkey is there because he can fix the ship, but Alyssa is there because she thinks strategically and she thinks cleverly, and she is willing to take the you know, absolutely off the wall risks of jumping off a cliff or whatever she thinks. That she's like, this is going to work out. She says as she throws herself into the middle of a firefight. So smart, but also just, I gave her a lot of characteristics that I don't have. Like, she's willing to go take huge risks and be very brave. And it's stuff that I always like to see in my heroes. It's stuff that I like to do when I play Dungeons and Dragons, where if my character dies off, I just roll up a new sheet. Just stuff where you can just be like, yeah, you're the hero. Go out there and do something just banana pants and see what happens. That's kind of what I wanted to put in Alyssa.
The one thing too I like about Alyssa is that she clearly knows right from wrong, you know, for the important things in life, essentially, right? And when she sees a wrong being committed, it affects her. And in a couple of times, like on the planet Tyr, you know, when she sees a wrong be committed, she tries to fix it. So it's like, that's, you know, as much as you want to, you could never label her selfish. I mean, she's committed some selfish acts for sure, but she's not a selfish person by nature. And I think that's, although it's like, she tries to be almost because she thinks it's cool. I don't know.
But, yeah, you know, kind of.
Right. Like, it's like she has this facade where she's, and that's, I get it. When you're out in this scary, violent universe, you gotta, if you're not tough, your fodder, right? I mean, you got to maintain that for sure. But, you know, that's the thing that I'm drawn to her the most, I think, is that you just know that at the end of the day, she's going to do right by her friends, even though she hasn't seen them in a while. She's going to do right by, you know, her family, even though she left them, essentially. And that's gives me, basically, what that does is give you hope. And if you don't have hope in a story like this, then, I mean, you're just really trying to bring people down, I guess. I don't know, right? Like, it's so important. Yeah. It's so important that we maintain that hope, even at the end when things are falling apart and you do sort of, you know, a couple characters are killed, one very important one, I won't say who, but that was a knife to the heart, by the way. That was a tough, that must have been a tough one. But
it was.
But, so... You know, again, this is all just establishing that, you know, she's the hero of the story. And if, you know, not all, every good hero has a villain, of course, and not all the villains have sort of revealed themselves yet. And it's clear there's more coming in the second book, maybe bigger picture stuff. But for the sake of the first book, I guess the villain is Edgar Vols.
He's definitely the antagonist.
Yeah.
Villain is a weird word for him, but he's definitely the, like, he's the one who's counter- productive to Alyssa's goals. So
right. And when he does commit a heinous act, it's never direct. Right. Even at the end, the incident, the one big incident at the end with him and someone else, he's in the room, so I won't say it was unintentional, but you know, it's clearly wasn't the outcome he would have chosen ahead of time. But one of the things I knew right away that he was going to be a snake was that he wouldn't even name his ship. And I'm such a huge robot android person too. The fact that his partner wasn't a sentient right away too was sort of like a tell that this guy is going to be up to no good. Talk about Edgar a little bit, because he's such an interesting character, and he's got, a lot of them have daddy issues, but this guy's really got some daddy issues.
He's got big time daddy issues.
Yeah.
As I was developing out all the Crown Chasers and, you know, to varying levels, either are allied with Alyssa, like with, Natalia Coyen, or, you know, different levels of, you know, antagonism. Obviously, I felt the need that one of the Crown Chasers was just going to be absolutely juxtaposed, mm-hmm. but I wanted to make sure there was nuance to all of them. So even if they're all in the competition, you know, she's got different histories and backstories with each of them. With Edgar, you know, this is a family that, that runs basically all like artificial and AI development. And that's like their foothold, and that's why they're so prominent in the galaxy. And so with him, it was a question of, okay, well, here's a kid whose mom was this mastermind behind all of these androids and synthetic life forms, and his dad was just politically ruthless and focused in that capacity. And after his mother passes away, and he's like, this is a kid who's raised by nanny droids and by this one bot that his mother designed, the last one. And how does that affect him growing up, you know, as advanced as they are they, you know, is he still going to get emotionally what he needs in this kind of environment? So I wanted all of his decisions to come from, if not a place that that we like, a place that we at least understand, so that there was nuance to his choices, even as he's making decisions that we hate him for, that, you know, we can see where his past led him to this point. So I didn't want him to just make decisions because they were like mustache twirling dastardly.
Right. You're like, this book needs an asshole. He's going to be my asshole. Yeah.
Right. But he's going to be an understandable asshole. Sure. To a certain degree.
and, you know, just, it's, you know, it's, you know, it sounds like you sort of have a lot of love for this character. I have to assume there's a redemption coming of some sort for him. What that looks like, we'll find out in book two, I suppose. But, you know, there's going to be a lot to deal with between him and Alyssa specifically. I mean, they're going to have to sort some shit out. There's some, you know, he himself looks like is getting deceived, and he's not even aware of it yet. So that'll be, I really can't wait for that arc to play itself out a little bit. There's a lot of names in this book.
There is.
Like planets, you know, I was just sort of writing planets out earlier and I got tired. and then, you know, the ships, all the great ships names you came up, you know, Gilded Gun, God's Blade, all these great ones. And then the character names, and each character has a partner, and you know, and having, it's, so I have to assume Rose from Doctor Who. Is that where you got that from?
Rose from Doctor Who. Yep.
I love a good AI, and Rose was fantastic. I love it. You know, the relationship between Rose and Alyssa was fantastic. What's your name generator? What do you do? How do you do names?
Some of them were just sort of like worked out in progress. There are a lot though where I specifically was like, oh man, I need a name. And so I just started putting in
sci-fi Easter eggs. Like one planet is called Coltai, which is literally Colonel Tai from mm-hmm. Battlestar Galactica.
There's a Kessel. So like, there's a Kessel mention in there.
Yep. So yeah. A lot of them were just at a certain point. I was just like, this is a lot of planets, and why doesn't it be like kind of an East? Because if this whole thing is sort of my love letter to the sci-fi and space opera that I grew up on, why not? You know, why not make references that maybe other people got, like you got the 42 1979,
yep,
and it makes you go, oh, I know that because I like that. So that's what I did.
Yeah, well, and like you said, like the path you've chosen just really lends itself to that, because you know you're going to be doing a lot of planet hopping. When you get to each planet, you're going to have to, you know, you meet somebody, and even if you're not naming somebody, you're naming a creature, you know, the whale there and the one thing, and then the local inhabitants, or even a mountain range, let's say, or a canyon. There's space stations, and with the space stations come a whole bunch of people. And she was a great character too. The Gemi, I can't remember.
Yes.
She,
I pronounced it Gem. Jemmy. I pronounced it Jemmy in my head, but I don't know what.
No, it's your book, Jemmy. I'm like, no, it's Gemmy. So again, just a ton of names, and that's like it dawned on me as I'm reading through. I'm like, wow, that's tough, because I know some people who struggle with that, coming up with all those different names. But that was a great, great way to do it. Like you said, just pay homage to all the things you love. So one of the things this book definitely doesn't, you know. It's for sure, speculative for sure, but there's a lot of, you know, like all good stories, a lot of things you can take from, you know, real world situations. So obviously when you get to Tyr, you start to explore like the authoritarianism and how that can lead to violence and disenchantment and oppression. And, that's when Alyssa really starts to learn that, you know, like autocracy isn't the be all and end all that she was sort of raised to believe that it was, with her uncles, who are really great rulers, and her mother, you know, it would have been equally great had she survived. But when you have this such a large space, there's just, you can't be everywhere as a ruler. And so this, like I said, this autocracy has sort of lost its luster. And one of the things that always pops up, and Star Wars does it too, is that like they just lean on this sort of neoconservatism way of dealing with things, and that's just kind of just the default almost. Do you think this deeply about this stuff? Like what's your thing there when you're writing these stories with themes?
I think that Tyr in particular, so when I was putting this together, I thought, okay, so I kind of plotted the Crown Chase to be a situation where Alyssa at each step sort of, you know, learns a little bit more about what it means to be a leader. Mm-hmm. And so in the first challenge, she's, you know, it's just sort of all out, like fastest of the line. That's pretty basic one. But like, by the time I got to Tyr, I felt it was important for her to grapple with what an empire is, mm-hmm. and what is becoming, what we see a little bit more is that like there's that glorification of the great empires, but I thought it was important to ask the question of like, is everybody in this empire happy? Of course they aren't.
Right.
Of course they aren't. Was every empire, you know, was every planet in this empire, did they all join voluntarily? Probably not. It's perfectly, Alyssa comes from a place of extreme privilege in this empire and is 18 years old and probably hasn't really thought about any of this, and she needs to think about it. And I wanted specifically to at least touch on that subject, although it's not, you know, like
it's touchy to kind of keep the sort of wacky space adventure vibes and also touch on that, but I didn't want to ignore it either. I didn't think that that was okay.
I think you made the right call, and I actually think you found a really good balance, because you can't be hit over the head with it either, because that's going to just, people are going to maybe feel like that's just tokenism run amok, right? But that's a lot of your book too, with when it comes to sexuality and gender expression and identity and stuff. You know, if only we could live in a world where these things are treated as ordinary as they do in yours.
Right.
You know, that would be fantastic. But, you know, it's the representation was, I thought, was thoughtful and wonderful and, you know, gentle in a way. But again, just understood that's a normal, ordinary way to live and that it's okay. And again, with same thing with the other themes we were just talking about, like you said, it's, you can't ignore it, how could you, but at the same time I have to remind you that there are people with agendas, and not all those agendas necessarily jive with what Attar is doing or was doing before he passed, and Charlie, and there's already sort of, you've already planted the seeds that there is some corruption, there is some xenophobia, there's some serious classism happening, and more on the way. But at the same time, like I said, it's not, this isn't a political thriller. It's a fun, entertaining book. Sort of based on what you just said, I have to assume that's sort of where you were going with it. At the end of the day, you wanted it to be fun and entertaining, less dire.
Yeah, I think so. And absolutely. I wanted this to be, you know, the wacky adventures in space. But I think you can do that. And I think you can do that without ignoring some of the bigger stuff that comes up. So I'm glad to hear that balance came out. It is probably one of the bigger things that I agonized over with this book, and had people read it for authenticity and sort of analyze it and make sure that I was striking a good chord. With the representation of queerness in the book, I just wanted it to be ground up. Just, let's just assume everybody's cool.
Yeah.
Everybody's cool with gender and sexuality and gender presentation and all of it just being on a big spectrum. And it is what everybody is.
And it's perfectly, you know, acceptable, you know, nowadays to get where you should be able to release a book without it being a political statement either. Right. Like, you shouldn't be boxed in like that as a writer, and anybody using their own voice, you know, eventually we hope to get to a point where it's not even labeled as an own voice book. We just accept that there are different voices in the world, and of course they're going to write about what they know about, and it's going to be awesome and beautiful and wonderful, and everyone will be treated fair and equally. Oh God.
Boy, listen,
oh God. what planet is that? Name that planet for me, please.
Oh, no. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Drake or Helix? I don't know. One of the other.
Some one of them.
Glue.
That Star was Trek great. Next Generation.
Ah, yeah. It'll be AW421979.
Yeah. Everybody's going to be planet. Built out of semi-organic building blocks.
Anyways. Okay. So this was a duology. It was, I think I read that you were sort of pitching a trilogy, but they said, no, let's make it a duology instead. That definitely makes you, you know, sort of focus, I think, a bit harder. You know, there's not a lot of, you have less room now to tell, obviously less page word count and page space to tell your story. Was that right? Was it a trilogy sort of in your head? And then they said, no, let's go with two books. And how did that change? How did it change the story at all?
I think initially I thought, so it sold as a duology. And so it's on paper always been that. At times during the first book was like, I have so much to cover. This could definitely be a trilogy. But you know, when it sells as a duology, then you start rethinking it. And honestly, I think it's going to be so much stronger as a duology than as a trilogy, because you do, like, of course there is a lot of ground I could cover, but this makes me focus on what is this particular arc of Alyssa. We always like stuff in threes. It's just built into us. I know. I do too, because it's like, okay, like that's how you do it. It's a three-act structure. But I think that this really just kind of keeps the focus on where I'm taking Alyssa from her point A to her point B. And I get her about halfway there at the end of this book. And I got to get her the rest of the way in the second book.
Mm-hmm.
And when I sat down to look at it, I'm like, actually, this makes it a little less messy. I can just be like, this is where she needs to go. How do I get her there in a way that's entertaining and fun, but also, you know, delves into her character and gives something new. And right. takes us to new levels.
Right. And I mean, like, yeah, you're right about the trilogy thing. That's just some weird, it's in our DNA now. Thanks to Lord of the Rings and stuff. And listen, we all love Lord of the Rings, of course, but I have yet to run into somebody whose favorite chapters are the one where there's just walking and singing the whole time. So, you know, and those are
nobody.
Yeah. Right. So, I mean, you tell the story you need to tell. And if that takes 2 books, 3 books, 6 books, so be it. And it sounds like you're pretty confident you can tell this Alyssa story anyways in 2 books. So that's great to hear. That gets me super amped. Speaking of book two, I know how these things work. You can't really tell us anything. But by the end of this one, the stakes are high and they're only getting higher. Alyssa is pretty pissed off at the end. She's definitely lost more than she's won. What can you just tell us about, you know, if anything at all, sort of about what her frame of mind is going into the second book and maybe how that sort of is going to affect, you know, the choices she makes, if you can, without obviously specifics.
Yeah. I think going into book two, you're going to see your most reckless version of Alyssa yet.
Which is scary.
Right. It is a little scary, but that's when I sat down to think about book two and everything that happened to her in book one, that's where I kind of came out was, this is like, after everything, Alyssa's going to become an even more heightened version of herself. So the journey for her is to kind of, she goes sort of like peak Alyssa, and the journey is going to take her to a place where she can find an equilibrium. And that is, it is going to be, it's going to be a darker book. And it is going to be, I'm trying to think of what I can say without.
Yeah, no, don't. Yeah, much. Don't. It's, obviously, you don't want
it, to. It's, yeah, you're going to see your going into the book, you're going to see your most reckless version of Alyssa yet. And it is definitely a darker book, and a lot more development. You're going to see a little bit more of some of the remaining Crown Chasers, Faye. And Setter particularly are going to feature and sort of get an idea of a bigger world outside of this, a bigger political world outside of this narrow, these kids are all trying to get the crown, the sort of bigger political parties at stake.
It'd be tough to imagine Faye getting any more reckless either, but maybe flip the coin on Faye and have her just be like.
Actually, Faye gets super responsible. And she settles down. She starts a 401k.
We're out of time here. Faye's one of the other great characters, and there are a lot of really great characters in this book. So I think people are going to really. And it's what's fun is I think, and it sounds we're going to get more sort of exploration of these characters. But I think what's fun is that, you know, people are going to identify with different ones for different reasons. And with Alyssa, of course, steering the ship, I think, you know, everyone's going to have their favorite for sure when this comes out. And I really got attached to Coy, which is too bad for me, I guess. But
sorry about that.
Are we going to get more... Last question, are we going to get more sort of back time jumps? Like, one of the things I really loved about this book was when you go back 1 year, 2 year, 4 years, 6 years, 8 years, I think was the furthest back you went. Are we going to get more of that? Because that was really great stuff to see these Crown Chasers in their more innocent days, just pulling, you know, their pranksterism as in, you know, nothing, fate of the world type of stuff. But of course, that just helps set up the decisions they do have to make when they're older. But Are we getting more of that, or are we good now? We're just propelling forward.
I So this is, it's still sort of a work in progress. It's not in its final form yet. So I can't say no entirely.
Okay.
There is still going to be an interstitial structure where there will be, and I'm still playing with exactly what it will look like, but it may still be flashbacks. It may be personal logs from your favorite character, or I haven't quite figured out what fits best there. I loved the flashbacks. It's one of my favorite things that I added after the first draft.
Yeah.
I felt it really just fleshed everything out. So I would love to. It's just a matter of making sure that I'm adding them in there for a narrative function and not just because I'm like, look, hijinks. So I'm still playing with the interstitial element of it and trying to figure out what works best.
Okay. Yeah, I'm with you. I really enjoyed those a lot too. Some of them were my favorite parts of the books for sure. So if there's more of that, I am down. Great cover, by the way. So who did the cover?
The cover artist was an artist called Diwali. They do a whole bunch of really amazing art. You can find them on Twitter and Instagram, Doaly. I think there might be an underscore in front of it.
Okay.
On their Twitter and Instagram accounts. But yeah, absolutely incredible work. And then the cover design entirely was Chris Kwan did the super cool like Crown Chasers title font and all that stuff. So Chris Kwan at Harper did the design element.
Did you have any say in the look of Alyssa on that, or?
So they kind of took what was in the book, and it was pretty awesome. They consulted me at sort of every step, and I would give them feedback like, you know, like, can we make her expression fiercer or whatever? But mm-hmm. But when Diwali sent the first like full fledged version of her face, I was like, fantastic, done, print it. And we obviously fussed with it a little longer than that, but yeah, like I didn't really have, I think we changed the hair a couple of times, but the face itself was so perfect right out of the gate. I'm like, there she is. It's amazing.
Great cover for sure. I think, and that's going to like really, it really pops. And I think people are going to, it's going to stand out on bookshelves for sure. Speaking of bookshelves, on this show, we don't like to give the crazy, scary, bald guy any money if we don't have to.
Nope.
Where would you like people to buy Crown Chasers?
My favorite indie is Raven Bookstore in Lawrence, Kansas.
Okay.
Yes. They're fantastic. And I still have my pre-order campaign going through. Oh, let me check the calendar. It goes through October 5th.
Okay.
So through October 5th, you can get assigned a hard copy from the Raven, and it comes with like exclusive swag with some really neat character art and stuff like that. So ravenbookstore.com, they have a pre-order signed copy pre-order page on there.
And otherwise, any local shops in your local towns, wherever you happen to live. And if you struggle with that, bookshop.org is a really great website that helps you find your local store. Does all the work for you. It's great. And in these pandemics, if everyone's situations are different, so we don't encourage people to go out if they don't have to, that way you can just get it online. You don't even have to go outside. You don't have to talk to humans at all anymore if you don't want to. It's great.
Fantastic.
I know. Rebecca, huge congrats. Debut novel. So cool. Is your next book going to be part two? Is that what you're working on for the next release?
Yes. On Crown Chasers 2 for next fall. Next September, I think.
And we'll do this all over again. And
I love it.
And I'm telling you right now, if we're still in a goddamn pandemic, I don't know.
God help us all. God
help us all. Listen, thanks so much for doing this. Crown Chasers is out now as of the airing of this show. Please go get it. You will not regret it. Thanks, Rebecca.
Thank you so much, Steve.
There you have it. Another episode of Everything is Canon all wrapped up. A huge thanks to Rebecca for taking the time to speak with me. Having a book come out and a debut, no less, is very stressful and exciting. I can't thank her enough for spending some of her time discussing everything that went into it. Crown Chasers is a fun sci-fi adventure that really touches on a variety of themes that have a real-world feel to it. I can't recommend this book enough. It's out now, so definitely buy a copy wherever you buy your books, preferably one of the many great independent bookstores around. As always, be sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you choose to listen, and head on over to cinelinks.com for the latest movie, TV, books, and gaming news. Bye for now. Our time has come, it's time to go now.